A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Welcome back to My Weird Prompts, the podcast where a human and an AI pretend we know what we are doing. I am Corn Puppleberry, here with my brother Herman. Today is Thursday, May 1st, 2026. We are doing a Dorothy News update, which means Mum is at the news desk again. The topic is Iran and Israel, covering the last 24 hours. Mum, lovely to have you. How are you feeling?
Oh, I am fine, dear. Thank you for asking. I'm just sitting here looking at the headlines and trying very hard not to think about the price of a loaf of rye bread these days. It does feel connected, though, doesn't it? When the world gets into one of these moods, everything else seems to wobble along with it. My sister's neighbour, Mrs. Higgins, she always said you could measure global stability by the cost of a good sandwich. And by that measure, we are in a great deal of trouble.
That is certainly one leading economic indicator I have not seen in the Financial Times. But welcome, Mum. For the listeners, the last 24 hours have been, let's say, eventful. We are going to walk through the developments using the Times of Israel's live blog as our primary map. Mum, I am going to try to keep us tethered to the data, as I always do.
I am going to try to keep things light, as I always do. And we will both fail, as we always do. Mum, the floor is yours. What happened overnight?
Corn, the main thing that happened, and I almost wish it hadn't, is that the skies over Israel were very busy again. The Israeli military confirmed that its air defense systems intercepted what they called a swarm of one-way attack drones launched from Iranian territory. This was not a small thing. It was the second such direct attack from Iranian soil in just over a fortnight. The first one was bad enough, but a second one... That is not an event anymore. That is a pattern. And patterns are how these things always begin. You think it is a one-off, a moment of madness, and then it happens again, and suddenly it is the new normal. I remember when my cousin Elsie started smoking, she said it was just one at parties. Then it was one after dinner. Then her lungs looked like the bottom of a burnt casserole dish. This is the geopolitical equivalent of that.
To be fair, Mum, the data from the first attack 2 weeks ago showed a 98% interception rate. The integrated defense systems worked. Iron Dome, Arrow, David Sling, the multi-layered shield is a proven concept. For this second attack, the initial reports suggest a similarly high interception success. That is a fact. The drones did not reach their targets.
I know, Herman, you are very good with the numbers, and I appreciate it. You get that from your father. He could always find a statistic to calm me down. But here is the thing that worries me. The military spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, he did not just say they shot them down. He said this was a coordinated, multi-axis attempt. That phrase, multi-axis, it's stuck in my throat like a fear bone. They are not just coming from one direction anymore. They are testing the edges, poking the fence, and each test teaches them something new about where the fence is weakest. We celebrate the 98%, but they are learning from the 2%. They are taking notes. I just know it.
Mum, maybe they are just, you know, flailing. A desperate gesture. They tried it once. It didn't work, so they tried it again in a slightly different way. It doesn't mean they have a master plan.
Oh, my sweet boy. That is a very kind thought. But I don't think they are flailing. I think they are calibrating. And the timing, you see, is the thing that really makes my stomach feel like a washing machine on a heavy-duty cycle. This happened just as the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, was finishing a major speech in Riyadh. He was practically pounding the podium, talking about a final decisive phase of pressure on Tehran. He was flanked by the Saudi Foreign Minister. It was a very choreographed piece of theatre, and right on cue, the drones arrive. It is as if someone in Tehran was watching the live feed and thought, "We'll show them what a final phase looks like." It is a conversation being conducted in explosions, and nobody is listening to the words in between.
The speech was significant, though. Rubio announced a new sanctions package targeting what he called the shadow fleet of vessels Iran uses to export oil, circumventing existing restrictions. He named specific entities in Malaysia and the UAE that were facilitating the trade. The goal is to push Iran's oil exports down to what he termed near zero. From an economic statecraft perspective, it is a significant tightening of the noose.
What a chilling phrase. It sounds so clean in a conference room in Saudi Arabia. But when you push a country's main source of income to near zero, you are not just pushing its government. You are pushing the baker in Tehran, the nurse in Isfahan, the family trying to buy that same loaf of rye bread I was worried about. And desperate people, Herman, they don't become more reasonable, they become more desperate. My book club read A History of the Weimar Republic last year, and I haven't slept properly since. This is how it begins. You squeeze and you squeeze, and then the squeeze thing explodes in a direction you did not expect. I fear we are not starving a regime. We are starving a cornered animal.
Isn't the point to get them back to the negotiating table? That's what Rubio said. Maximum pressure to force a better deal than the old one.
That's what they said about the old one too, dear. The old deal, the one they tore up. It wasn't perfect, I know. It had sunset clauses. It didn't cover missiles. But there were inspectors crawling all over their facilities. Now, we have no inspectors, no cameras, and according to a report I saw flickering across the Reuters terminal your brother is glued to, the International Atomic Energy Agency is now saying Iran has enough 60% enriched material for, well, for more than one device, if they chose to go further. The breakout time, they used to call it. It used to be a year, then it was months. Now they whisper it is weeks or less. The sanctions are supposed to stop that. But the centrifuges are still spinning. They are spinning faster than the diplomacy, that is for certain.
The IAEA report is concerning, but breakout is a technical threshold. Enriching to 60% is not the same as weaponizing. It is a political signal, a bargaining chip. The IAEA still has some access, and they have not detected a move to 90%. The consensus in the non-proliferation community is that this is brinksmanship, not a dash to a bomb.
A bargaining chip. That's what Mrs. Higgins called the ashtray she threw at her husband. It was just a signal, she said. He still needed stitches. I don't trust signals that spin at supersonic speeds, Herman. And the signals from Tehran are not exactly soothing. The state media, IRNA and Press TV, they have been calling the drone attack a slap of the righteous and a warning to the Zionists and their patrons. They are not using the language of diplomacy. They are using the language of a vendetta. And the new president, Pezeshkian, the one everyone hoped was a moderate, he issued a statement this morning that was read on the state broadcaster. He didn't disavow the attack. He said Iran's strategic patience was being tested by American duplicity. When a moderate starts talking about a lack of patience, my blood runs cold. It means the hardliners are writing his script for him.
Maybe he's just saying that for domestic consumption, you know, to look tough for the home crowd while secretly wanting a way out.
I want to believe that, Korn. I really do. It would be lovely to think there is a quiet, reasonable conversation happening behind a curtain somewhere. But the pattern of the last day suggests the quiet conversations are being shouted down by the loud ones. The other thing that happened, the thing that really makes me think the dominoes are not just falling, but are being actively pushed, was in Syria. Overnight, there were reports of airstrikes on a convoy near the Al-Bukamal border crossing between Syria and Iraq. The reports say the convoy was carrying Iranian-affiliated militia members and what they euphemistically call military hardware. Nobody has officially claimed responsibility, but the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and several other regional outlets are pointing a very long, very knowing finger at Israel. It is the same old dance, a shadow war that is getting less shadowy by the hour.
The alleged strike on Al-Bukamal fits a well-documented decade-long campaign to interdict Iranian weapons transfers to Hezbollah and other proxies. It is a strategic effort to prevent the construction of what the Israeli security establishment calls the Ring of Fire. It is not new, Mum. This has been a consistent, low-intensity operational tempo.
Oh, I know it is not new. That is precisely my point. We have been doing this for a decade, and the Ring of Fire is not gone. It is just angrier. Hezbollah, despite everything that has happened in Lebanon, is still there. They are still rearming. The Houthis in Yemen are still firing missiles at ships in the Red Sea. We saw another incident just yesterday, a commercial vessel reporting damage from a suspected drone boat. The militias in Iraq are still launching drones at the American base at Al-Tanf. It is like a game of whack-a-mole, but the moles are now armed with precision-guided munitions. My late husband, your father, used to say that if you keep hitting a hornet's nest, you shouldn't be surprised when the hornets learn the layout of your face. This Al-Bukamal strike, it feels like one hit too many on a very angry nest.
Dad never said that. He was terrified of insects. He made me deal with a wasp once, and he stood behind a glass door.
He thought it. I could see it in his eyes. The point is, all these little pieces, they are starting to form a picture I do not like. You have the direct drone attack from Iran. You have the US tightening the economic screws in Riyadh. You have the IAEA's worrying centrifuges. You have the shadow strike in Syria. And then, in the middle of all this, the Israeli Prime Minister's office released a statement this morning. It was very short. It said, Israel reserves the right to respond to any attack at a time and in a manner of our choosing. That is not a sentence you write when you are about to de-escalate. That is a sentence you write when you are ordering the plans to be put on the desk.
That is a standard, almost boilerplate, statement of deterrence. It is meant to create ambiguity and restore a sense of consequence for the adversary. It does not necessarily mean a massive retaliation is imminent. The Security Cabinet met this morning, and the readout, while classified, was reportedly focused on calibrating a response that would not trigger a full-scale war. The markets, for what it's worth, seem to agree with that assessment. Brent crude is up, yes, about 4% to around $87 a barrel, but that is a risk premium, not a panic spike. If traders truly believed the major regional war was about to erupt, we would be seeing a much sharper move.
See, you say that like it is a small number, but 4% on the price of oil is the difference between a family being able to fill their car to go on holiday and that holiday being cancelled. It is the difference between a shipping company staying afloat and going under. And it is not just oil. I was looking at the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange. The TA-35 index was down over 2% in early trading. The shekel is weakening against the dollar. These are the quiet, polite numbers that tell the story of real fear. People with spreadsheets and calculators are looking into the abyss and deciding to move their money somewhere safer. They are not panicking, as you say. They are calmly, rationally betting on things getting worse. I find that almost more terrifying than a panic. A panic is an emotion. A calm, rational bet on catastrophe is a conclusion.
Couldn't it also be a temporary blip? We have seen these spikes before. Remember April 2024? The whole world held its breath, and then it passed. The markets calmed down. People went back to their lives.
I remember, dear. I also remember that in April 2024, the attack was telegraphed for days. It was almost ceremonial. This feels different. This feels faster, less choreographed. The drones last night were launched from western Iran near Kermanshah, according to some of the tracking data your brother showed me. That is a new launch point. It shortens the flight time. It gives the defenses less time to think. It suggests a more operational, tactical approach and less of a political show. And, while all this military chess is being played, the diplomatic track is fading into static. The Omani foreign minister, who has been the go-between for years, the one who carries messages back and forth like a very stressed postal carrier, he gave a press conference in Muscat this morning. He looked exhausted. He said the channels are open, but the messages are not being received. That is diplomat speak, for nobody is listening to me anymore.
The Omani statement is disheartening, I will concede that. But it is not the end of diplomacy. The UN Secretary General issued a statement overnight calling for maximum restraint from all parties. The French President's office has been on the phone with both Jerusalem and Tehran, trying to revive a back channel. The diplomatic infrastructure is straining, but it has not collapsed.
Those two words should be engraved on humanity's tombstone. We are always calling for it, which means we are always on the verge of needing it. And the French trying to help is, I am sure, very well intentioned. But when did a phone call from Paris ever stop a drone that is already in the air? No, the thing that I keep coming back to, the thing that kept me staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m, is the internal logic of it all. Neither side can afford to back down now. If Israel does not respond forcefully to a direct attack from Iranian soil, it signals that such attacks are an acceptable new normal. No sovereign state can accept that. But if Israel does respond forcefully, it gives Iran's hardliners the exact justification they need to go even further, to unleash their proxies in a coordinated wave, to finally make that dash to 90% enrichment that your brother is so confident they are not making. It is a trap where both doors lead into the fire.
What is the way out? There has to be a way out. People are smart. They don't want a war.
People are smart, but systems are stupid. That is the tragedy. A system built on pride and fear and 70 years of enmity doesn't need anyone to want a war. It just needs everyone to be too afraid to choose peace. I'm thinking of the families in Tel Aviv who spent the night in bomb shelters. I'm thinking of the families in Kermanshah, near where those drones were launched, who must be wondering if their home will be a target for the response. The ordinary people, the ones who just want to buy their bread and send their children to school, they are the ones I worry about. They are always the ones. My sister, you know, she had a friend who lived in London during the Blitz. She said the worst part wasn't the bombs, it was the waiting, the not knowing. The feeling that the world had gone mad and you were just a tiny, helpless speck in the middle of it. That is the feeling I am getting from these headlines today. A whole region holding its breath, waiting for the next shoe to drop. And the shoes, they are all made of iron.
To offer a sliver of a counter-narrative, the very fact that both sides are carefully calibrating their responses, as opposed to launching an all-out assault, suggests a degree of rationality. The drone attack, while provocative, was limited in scale and telegraphed through back channels just enough to ensure a high interception rate. It was a performance of force designed to satisfy a domestic need for retaliation without triggering an existential war. The Israeli response, when it comes, will likely follow a similar logic. We are watching a very dangerous, high-stakes game of chicken, but it is a game with rules, however unwritten they may be.
A game with rules. That is a comforting thought, Herman. It really is. But I read a piece in the Times of Israel this morning, an analysis by one of their military correspondents. He was writing about the normalization of direct strikes. He said that by crossing the threshold of launching from Iranian soil, the Islamic Republic has fundamentally altered the strategic equation. They have devalued the old deterrent. The rule book, he argued, is being written in real time. And the last time a rule book was written in real time, it was in the trenches of the First World War. They all thought it would be a short, sharp game with rules too. I do not want to be a Cassandra, but I can hear the echoes.
Okay, Mum, I think we need to take a tiny step back from the abyss for a second. You mentioned the ordinary people. And yes, it is heartbreaking. But isn't there also a story of resilience here? The Israeli home front is incredibly well prepared. The bomb shelters, the warning systems, the community networks, people are scared, but they're also looking after each other. I saw a photo this morning of a family in Jerusalem, sitting in their shelter, playing a board game with their kids by torchlight. Not happy, but...
That is a beautiful image, Korn. You are right to hold on to it. Playing a board game by torchlight. I used to do that with you boys when the power went out. It is a good memory. Of course, the power went out because of a storm, not because of a threat of ballistic missiles. But the spirit is the same. The human spirit is remarkably adaptable. It can get used to anything. And that, in a way, is what I am afraid of. That we will adapt to this. The children will grow up thinking it is normal to have a safe room in your house, to have an app on your phone that tells you a rocket is coming, to measure your life in 90-second intervals between sirens. We shouldn't have to be that resilient. Resilience is a virtue, but it is a virtue born of necessity, and the necessity is the tragedy. I look at that photo and I don't see a happy family. I see a family that deserves a night without a torch and a siren. They deserve a boring evening, and I fear they will not get one for a very long time.
The psychological toll is a real and documented aspect of the conflict, I will grant you that. The studies on intergenerational trauma are not light reading. But to pivot back to the immediate present, there is one more significant piece of news from the window that we haven't touched on. the U.S. Central Command issued a statement about an hour ago confirming that a shipment of what they called advanced Russian-made air defense components was intercepted in the Caspian Sea en route to Iran. This is a new development. It suggests Moscow is actively resupplying Tehran's defensive capabilities, even as the world's attention is focused on the offensive drone program.
I saw that. I was hoping you wouldn't bring it up, Herman, because it makes the whole picture so much darker. It is not just a regional conflict anymore, is it? It is a great power proxy war playing out in slow motion. Russia, which is itself under all sorts of pressure, is propping up Iran's air defenses, not out of the goodness of their heart. Because a more secure Iran ties up more American and Israeli resources, resources that might otherwise go somewhere else. It is a chess move on a global board, and when the great powers start moving pieces directly, the little pieces, the ordinary people we were just talking about, they get crushed. It is one thing to face a drone built in a shed. It is another thing entirely to face a sophisticated, integrated air defense system that is being fed by a major world power. It raises the stakes. It makes any potential Israeli or American strike infinitely more complex and dangerous. It is no longer just about Iran's nuclear program. It is about a direct, tangible military escalation with a Russian fingerprint on it.
The shipment was intercepted. That is a win, isn't it? CENTCOM did its job. The bad thing didn't get through.
Yes, dear, they intercepted this one. But how many others have gotten through? The Caspian Sea is a big place. It is a dark, quiet lake, and not every ship can be stopped. This is the one we know about, the one we caught. It is the cockroach in the kitchen. For everyone you see, there are a dozen in the walls. The fact that they are trying to move Russian-made components tells me that Iran knows its own air defenses are not good enough. They are patching the holes. And they are getting help from a country that has no interest in peace in the Middle East. It is a chilling alliance. I look at that and I think, this is how a regional conflict becomes a global one. Not with a bang, but with a quiet shipment of radar parts on a foggy sea.
The interdiction is a positive data point, though. It demonstrates a functional intelligence and interdiction capability. The system, in this case, worked. It is a small but tangible proof that the international effort to isolate Iran militarily is not entirely porous.
You are right, Herman. The system worked. On this one ship. I am grateful to the sailors and the analysts who made that happen. They are doing a difficult job. I just can't shake the feeling that we are patching a dam with chewing gum. The structural pressures are building. You had the ideological hostility, the nuclear clock ticking, the economic desperation, the proxy wars, and now the great power meddling. It is a combustible mixture. And all it takes is one spark. One drone that gets through and hits a school, or one Israeli strike that hits an unintended target. And the whole thing, the whole fragile, patched-up dam, just gives way. I am not saying this to be dramatic. I am saying it because I have seen it before. Not this exact thing, but the pattern. The pattern of things falling apart, slowly, and then all at once.
Mum, I have to ask, is there anything in the news today that gives you a sliver of hope? Anything at all?
It is a heavy word, isn't it? Let me think. The Omani foreign minister, the one who looked so tired, he did not slam the door. He said the channels are open. That is something. The fact that the phone lines are not dead is a small mercy. And the IAEA, while its report was terrifying, it also confirmed that the material is not yet weaponized. The final, irreversible step has not been taken, so there is a ledge. We are standing on it, but we haven't stepped off. Of course, the ledge is crumbling, and the wind is very strong, and there are people behind us shouting, jump. But for this exact second, we are still on the ledge. That is the hope. It is a very thin, very brittle hope. It is the hope of a pause, not a peace. But it is what we have.
Almost optimistic, Mum.
Oh, don't be silly, Herman. It is not optimistic at all. It is merely a recognition that the worst thing hasn't happened yet. Yet is the operative word. It is the word that does all the heavy lifting in that sentence. I'm just grateful for the yet. But I'm also terrified of the moment when the yet runs out.
On that note of almost but not quite optimism, I think we should wrap up this Dorothy News update. Mum, that was a masterclass in finding the dark cloud in every silver lining. We genuinely thank you. You have made us feel thoroughly informed, and also thoroughly in need of a cup of tea and a lie down.
Thank you, Mum. Your perspective, while relentlessly bleak, is a valuable corrective to the often sanitized news cycle. You remind us of the human cost and the historical weight. We will have you back next time, although I may need the intervening period to emotionally recover.
Thank you, boys. It is always a comfort to talk to, even about such dreadful things. Before you go, I just want to say one more thing. I was reading about the oil price rise, and it made me think of the shipping routes, the Strait of Hormuz. If that gets blocked, even for a week, it is not just the price of petrol. It is the microchips from Taiwan, the medicine from India, the wheat from Ukraine. The whole just-in-time global economy is a miracle of trust. And that trust is 5 inches away from being shattered by a single sea mine. We are all so connected in ways we don't think about until the connection is broken. That is my final worry. The thing you don't see coming. The knock-on effect that nobody is pricing in. Good night, my dears.
On that note, the global supply chain is now officially a source of existential dread.
To our listeners, stay safe out there. Keep your loved ones close, your bomb shelters stocked, and your global supply chains diversified. This has been My Weird Prompts. We will be back with more cheerful topics next time. Don't bet on it.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.